The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for August 19th, 2017. I'd like to begin with a quick reminder that the annual Ride for Miles, which starts and ends right here at John Carroll University, takes place Sunday, September 24th. It's a non-competitive bicycle ride. It's about 15 miles, and it raises funds for environmental and bicycling education. This project continues Dr. Miles Coburn's work of educating students and the community about the urgency of environmental activism. Pretty timely, I'd say. Dr. Miles Coburn was killed riding his bicycle, and his family and friends created the ride to both honor the man and help to continue the work that he so passionately loved. So for more information about the Ride for Miles, go to ride4miles.org. Now it's on to our show for tonight. My first guest is Niles Barnes. Niles is the director of Greenway Programs for the East Coast Greenway. His background includes environmental management. He is particularly passionate about developing the physical trail of the Greenway, as well as the potential it has to create a sustainable future that includes more healthy and prosperous local communities along the entire eastern seaboard. This coming Thursday, August 24th, the East Coast Greenway River Rally kicks off in celebration of the 25th anniversary of the Greenway. According to the information on the website, quote, for 10 weeks, we'll be visiting communities along the East Coast Greenway and encouraging everyone to celebrate healthy watersheds, active living, and local culture. They start in Maine, August 24th, and end in Key West, October 30th. It's a 3,000-mile party, and you're invited. Niles will be filling us in on what will happen at each of the partner stops along the way and how you can get in on the activities and fun. Then we're going to take a break for a couple of real quick news items before welcoming veteran frame builder Kelly Bedford. Kelly lives and works in upstate New York near Saratoga Springs. He spent 21 years with the Cerata Frame Building Factory and now offers K. Bedford Customs out of his own shop. We'll learn about his philosophy, his frames, and chat a bit about the time he spent with the Cerata team building such iconic bikes as the 7-Eleven team machines. So let's find out more about the East Coast Greenway River Rally from Niles Barnes. Hi, Niles. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me today, Diane.
Well, you know, I have a special place in my heart for the East Coast Greenway Alliance, as everybody knows. So there's lots of cool things going on. I guess I should have known this being a board member, but I did not realize it's the 25th anniversary. Tell us what that's all about.
That's right. Yeah, we started that celebration actually last fall in Providence, Rhode Island. It was 25 years ago last Thanksgiving in November when the founders came together. So we recognized and celebrated a lot of our founders and founding board members in Providence. And the East Coast River Relay is a continuation of that 25th anniversary celebration.
And that's what I want to talk about. It's a 3,000-mile event. It kicks off next weekend. Tell us about the East Coast Greenway Alliance River Relay, because it alludes to all the water.
That's right. Yeah, we're really excited. We're calling it 50 Rivers, 25 Years, One Greenway. And the East Coast Greenway crosses a number of rivers. The East Coast Greenway is built within riparian zones and along many rivers. So over the course of 10 weeks, we'll be connecting with communities, both urban and rural, and hosting over 60 public events, a variety of different types of events, from bicycle rides, cleanups, tree plantings. We're going to be doing events at festivals, film screenings, 5K runs, barbecues, beer socials, something for everyone.
I guess. So do people have to sign up for these different events, or do they just show up?
Some events, we do ask for registration, so folks can check out our brand-new website, greenway.org. We've got an events section where we've got the whole calendar of River Relay events. So we are kicking off August 24th in Calais, Maine, and we're going to be ending in Key West, Florida, at the end of October. But you can see every event that we've got planned, details of when and where, and we encourage folks to register in advance if it's necessary, or show up the day of and enjoy the celebration.
So let's pick a couple of the events. We'll start with the first one, the one in Maine, in Calais, Maine. Tell us what that one's going to be, and then we'll kind of cherry pick a couple and end up in Key West, one of my favorite places, by the way.
Yeah, this is really exciting. So this is going to be hosted at the Wabanaki Culture Center in Calais, Maine. We've got a number of different partners, including the Washington County Council of Governments, there in Maine, the Passamaquoddy Tribe, the City of Calais, and the Scutic River Keepers. And so this event is going to include a canoe regatta on the St. Croix River. It's going to be the send-off for the core cyclists, including myself, that will be biking this section of the river relay. We're going to have drumming. We're going to have a celebration of communities and people in the area. And it's going to be a lot of fun. And that is going to be from 8:30 to 10:30 in the morning on Thursday, August 24th.
So from there, you're heading to Maine, Brunswick, Maine. Is that right?
That's right. And if folks are interested in seeing each of these events, you can go to our River Relay webpage. And the next major event that we've got in Maine is actually we're going to be tabling and speaking at the American Folk Festival in Bangor, Maine. And that's on August 26th.
What does tabling mean?
Tabling means we'll have information about the Greenway, T-shirts, stickers, different types of swag. We'll have staff and riders there available to answer questions.
Okay, and then there's a paddle.
Yep, we're going to do paddling, historic paddling tour on the Androscoggin River. We're going to have a bird walk in Scarborough, Maine. We've got a lot of wonderful things planned in the state of Maine.
So what's interesting is there are 14 pages of events on the website, and I'm just going to randomly pick page 6. And in Richmond, Virginia, there's a film showing and a social. And your partners are the Groundwork RVA. So in each location, you have people partnering to put on whatever the events are. So do you know anything about this film showing and the social? What is that about? Do we know?
Yeah, so this is an exciting part. Richmond, Virginia has had incredible trail development. A lot of folks who are in the Trails and Greenways movement are probably familiar with the Virginia Capitol Trail. It connects Richmond over to Jamestown, Virginia, 42 miles, complete off-road paved greenway along the James River. But we're going to be crossing the James River at another point, going through Belle Isle Park and doing a social at a great coffee shop cafe that'll be hosting us. And we've got partners like Groundwork RVA doing great group, great activities with youth in the community. One piece about this river relay, you know, we are still a small organization in terms of staff, so we do rely on partners. We've got over 110 partners that are helping us organize events, including over 40 watershed and riverkeeper groups. So we're excited about the partnerships and all the groups that are helping us make these events a success.
How long did it take to put this river relay concept together?
Been thinking about the concept for quite a while, and we were really fortunate to get funding from the Williamson Foundation, who's been supporting work in the Delaware watershed and greenways and trails development in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. It committed to this project, and so they're helping us launch and do this river relay. But we hired a river relay program manager We've grown our staff. We have 6 regional coordinators now. And our volunteer network really grew. At the end of 2016, we had over 50,000 people in our network and getting East Coast Greenway communications. So that's also enabled and helped us have the capacity to put on this series of events.
Well, there's a really interesting event coming up October 12th in Beaufort, South Carolina, the Spanish Moss Trail bike ride and walk and a ribbon cutting. And this is Friends of the Spanish Moss Trail are your partners. Tell us about the ribbon cutting. This is a brand new trail opening as part of the Greenway.
Yeah, this is a section of trail that is incorporated into the East Coast Greenway route and trail network. So at the end of 2016, we incorporated over 40 new miles of trail into the Greenway network. And there's new development in the Spanish Moss area in Beaufort, South Carolina. So this will be a celebration of the new trail segment with local leaders, including some elected officials. And it'll also be part of a tour that we're having. We're actually going to have 40 cyclists biking through this section of the River Relay on our week a year tour. So a lot of exciting things happening as we make our way to Savannah, Georgia.
Well, the last part of the event is in Key West. So a lot of people may or may not know there is almost always a Halloween festival in Key West. It's crazy. You are ending up Monday, October 30th in Key West. The partner for the East Coast Relay finale is the city of Key West. What's going to happen down there? Is everybody going to go crazy and watch the sunset and applaud?
That's what we hope. We'll get out on the water. We'll celebrate a safe and fun event. And I do want to back up one big event that we're having October 1st through 3rd is our Southeast Greenways and Trails Summit.
Okay.
And that's a special event. We've never put it on before. It is the first time we've held it. It's targeting kind of the 5-state Virginia to Florida region, but also surrounding southern states. And we've got elected officials at the local state level, advocates, planners, transportation engineers coming to Durham, North Carolina over the course of 3 days to celebrate, engage, network, and talk about how to accelerate greenways and trail development in the Southeast. So that's something I'd also want to highlight. Folks that might want to come down for that, we're going to have active events. We're going to have keynotes, plenaries, beer gardens, music. It's going to be a lot of fun, and that is an event that you do have to register for in advance. But registration is up, and folks that want to join the River Relay and get involved in East Coast Greenway projects in early October, that would be a great opportunity.
Yeah, that's October 1st through 3rd again. So let's talk just for a moment, instead of just about the River Relay, about the East Coast Greenway itself. There's a lot of it completed. A lot of it is getting completed ongoingly. What's left to accomplish in getting the entire north to south greenway completely connected?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So we have a totally mapped out route, and we've got a number of folks we call end-to-enders that have ridden the whole route. You know, we're not just an org of bikers, though. We encourage walking and use of the trail for transportation as well, not just recreation. But in 2016, we rolled out a strategic plan through 2020, and part of that plan is the ambitious goal to designate and build 200 more miles of the East Coast Greenway and to also have the route fully signed with directional signage so people have an easier time traveling along the route. And in 2016, as I mentioned, we designated over 40 new miles of Greenway and incorporated that into the East Coast Greenway experience. So those were miles that previously were on roadways and now are traffic separated and protected. We also signed a record amount of signage, so 300 more miles of directional signs were installed in 2016. So we're excited about that. We're trying to build on that momentum and keep it going really strong. And so we've got some states that are further ahead. Rhode Island is one of the most complete states in the East Coast Greenway Network, over 60% on traffic-separated greenways. And then we have some other states that are not as far along, and we're prioritizing and putting energy into getting more trail on the ground. So a lot of work to do, a lot of opportunities for people to get engaged. Folks that might want to volunteer or get involved in our programs, we recommend checking out greenway.org and getting plugged into the system.
Well, has anybody yet gone north to south? Not necessarily somebody from the organization, but just somebody who just said, I'm going to go from Maine to Florida and use as much of the Greenway as possible. Do you track that kind of thing? People who use it?
Yes. Yep. We've got a section riding end to end on our new website.
Ah.
The folks that want to take on that challenge. And the first group was in 2004. We had 7 cyclists that rode the entire East Coast Greenway. They started in Calais, Maine. They went to Key West 55 days. And we do track and celebrate folks. We had a nice woman, Stephanie, with her dog, Murph, who rode end to end. Murph was sometimes riding, running along in the bike and sometimes in the trailer. But we've got a great group of folks and stories captured on our website about their experiences.
Do you have any idea, and not particularly one state versus another or one area versus another, but do you have any idea of what the economic impact of having a trail like this coming through a specific community is to that community?
Yeah, the impact can be very significant. We estimated that the East Coast Greenway attracted over $1 billion of public investment in the first 25 years. So, you know, we're about 30% complete. And the economic impact of that has been very significant. It certainly increases tourism. There have been a number of studies that we've partnered on looking specifically at the economic impact of particular segments. How are people using it? Some are using it to get to jobs, to go shopping, to run errands, to get to school. But it is significant, and we think that will only increase as we get more of the trail constructed and built. The corridor goes through a very dense areas. You know, we go through the heart of cities. About 60 million people live within about 25 miles of the East Coast Greenway. So we think the impact will only increase as we get more of the greenway built.
Well, I certainly am excited about, you know, we'll be on the East Coast in September. We are at the New England Builders Ball with our friend Eric Weiss. And I'm anxious to see, you know, we're giving a portion of the Builders Ball proceeds to the East Coast Greenway. So obviously you do depend on donations and as well as other kinds of grants and what other funding comes along. I want to let people know how they can get involved with the Greenway, either working with you peoples or us peoples, as we say, or working on the river relay or just enjoying the Greenway. How do they get more information, Niles?
Well, come to greenway.org. There's a way to join and become a member or make a donation. And we really appreciate the support, especially from events like the New England Builders Ball. This is a little bit of a sneak peek, Diane. We're going to do the public launch very soon, but we have a whole new mapping platform and tool, map.greenway.org, that folks can use. And funds that are raised from events like that can help us with mapping, help us with our signage, and ultimately help accelerate and get more trail built quicker. So we really appreciate the support. It doesn't have to be financial, too. We always can use more volunteer and citizen support as well, too, to help us out. So that would be great.
Well, I hope you enjoy. How much of the river relay are you doing? You're going to be, I know you're going to be at the summit in October, but what else will you be participating in?
Yeah, I'll be riding from Calais, Maine to Portland, Maine. And then I'll also be physically riding from Hartford down to Philadelphia. And, of course, I'll be at the Southeast Summit in Durham in the Triangle region. And then I'll be picking back up with the river relay in Florida and helping ride us in along the Keys and in Miami. So love to meet as many people that listen to the show, too. I'm a fan, a friend of the pod, so
thank you. A friend of the pod. I haven't heard that. I like that. Can I use that? Can I steal that?
Please.
Oh, I will. Well, Niles, thanks so much for taking time to talk with me. Say hello to Dennis and all of the other wonderful people I work with on the East Coast Greenway Alliance board. And good luck with the relay. We will check back in. I'll tell you what, let's promise to check back in when you end up in Key West in October.
Sounds like a plan.
All right.
Diane.
Have fun.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Niles Barnes joined me from his office in Durham, North Carolina. Once again, the East Coast Greenway River Rally kicks off next Thursday in Maine and rock and rolls all the way down to Key West on October 30th. So if you are interested, go to greenway.org and see if there's a portion of the party you want to join or maybe more than one. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back and we will have some news and then we'll go talk to Kelly Bedford. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
we'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of the Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Back, and as promised, I have a couple of news items. We haven't been doing much news lately, but these two items just came up and I thought they were interesting. This week, the U.S. Bicycling Hall of Fame announced its 2017 inductees. In a statement on the website, the announcement partly reads, quote, "The honorees represent several disciplines within the sport of cycling. The inductees are Roy Nickman, modern road and track competitor, Lawrence Malone, off-road competitor, Tim Mountford, veteran road and track competitor, and Joe Salling, contributor to the sport. With the class of 2017, there are now a total of 154 inductees in the U.S. Bicycling Hall of Fame. The induction weekend will be held November 10th through 11th, 2017, in Davis, California, and features a celebration of American cycling. The public is welcome to join. Bicycling Hall of Fame members, cycling industry leaders, and cycling enthusiasts for a free club ride on Saturday, November 11th, and the inductees ceremony that evening. Tickets for the November 11th induction ceremony at the UC Davis Arc Facility are available for purchase online at squareup.com. I will post something on our website about it. For more information, visit usbhof.org. And congratulations to all four of the new inductees. Then it's back to another Lance Armstrong controversy, only this one is a little bit different. Just before the Colorado Classic, USADA let the organizers know that their USA Cycling sanction would be rescinded if they persisted in broadcasting Lance Armstrong's Stages podcast. The race organizers capitulated, and the deal between the Classic and Mr. Armstrong was abandoned. This week, journalist Mark Peruzzi penned an article in Outside Magazine titled, quote, "In Defense of Lance Armstrong and His Freedom of Speech," end quote. The gist of the article was that by gagging Armstrong's podcast effort, regardless of what you think of Mr. Armstrong personally, the action is just bad for the sport. The article makes some great points, and I think I have to agree that it's perhaps not the place of USADA to sanction Lance for his commentary. It's enough that they've banned him from participating in the sport in any other way. You can read the article in its entirety on OutsideOnline.com from August 12th. I'm open to hearing your point of view on this. If you're interested in sharing it, you can comment on Twitter, Facebook, or send an email to outspokencyclist@gmail.com to offer your opinion. So let's get back to our show and welcome my next guest, frame builder Kelly Bedford. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today. How are you?
I'm just fine. Hope everybody there is good.
I think we're all okay. You are in the... So I don't know exactly where your shop is, but I know the area really well. My husband's from a little town called Northville.
Yeah, Greenfield Center is kind of just very slightly northwest of downtown Saratoga. I'm like 6 miles from downtown Saratoga Springs, so very close, but it's more rural out here, you know. It's not as populated, so it's a little more peaceful.
Well, I really like the Saratoga Springs area. I think it's really a cool town.
It's pretty nice here, that's for sure.
Well, let's talk about you and your history in our world of frame building. You actually have a pretty long history, so why don't you give us a little bit about yourself and how you got into frame building and when?
Well, not long after high school, I started working in bike shops. I actually kind of followed my brother into it because he was a pretty hotshot racer back then, and like a lot of racers, he kind of subsidized his racing by working in bike shops. And, you know, as he was moving around, racing, going to college and stuff like that, I would kind of fall into the job he left behind. So I got started in the retail industry that way. doing mechanic work and then sales and eventually managing shops and stuff like that. But during that period of time, and this was probably when I was, I don't know, 19, 20, something like that, it would be time, downtime, if you will. And I've always kind of, my background is in art anyway, and making things and stuff like that. So I got interested in the possibility of trying to build my own bike frame, because I couldn't, at the time, I couldn't afford good bikes. So, and I was into cycling back then myself, not so much racing. But so I got my hands on some tubing through a company called Proteus, which was in, I think it was Maryland, if I'm not mistaken, or
yep.
Rhode Island. I'm not sure. Yeah. And anyway, I bought a frame building kit from them, and myself and the guy that I worked in the shop with, we both did the same thing, and we set sail on building ourselves our first bikes per the Proteus method, which taught you how to do frames without a jig. So we did that, and it came out very nice. So that was very encouraging. And, you know, after I did that, I built one for my brother, and then people started seeing them. So I would have people ask me here and there, and I did them for very little money. It's not really what I was doing for a business, but little by little, you know, the numbers piled up, and I had done quite a few. And then when I was, I guess, 27-ish, I was born and raised in South Florida, and my wife and I were living down there. I was managing a shop, and I got a phone call from someone that I had previously worked with, and unbeknownst to me, he had started working for Serrata a year before, and Ben was getting ready to start to expand his business at that time, which he knew meant it was going to take him away from the building end of his business, so he wanted somebody with some experience, and this friend knew what I'd been doing, so he recommended me, and I went up there, I think it was January of 1986, and was there for a couple days trying out, and things went well, and, you know, we were both excited, because he saw that I had some potential and whatnot, and during that time, they were getting ready to start building the first Tour de France bikes for the 7-Eleven team, so I did a special lug cut for him while I was up there, so I went back home to Florida, and over the next year, they would send me sets of lugs, which I would cut into this pattern and send them back to them so they could build the bikes. So that went on for a year, and then when everything was ready, he had everything set there, and we made the move, and I've been up here ever since, working. I worked for Serrata from 1987 to December of 2008.
Wow, that's a long, long time.
Yeah.
Very interesting, interesting. Tell me what you remember about the evolution of the Serrata size cycle.
Well, that was, you know, to me, that was one of the kind of the more, that whole system, the size cycle itself and the system that was developed around that was probably one of the more major, to me, one of the more major contributions to the, you know, to the industry, if you will, in the sport of cycling. Because back then, when Ben first started playing around with that, nobody was thinking in terms of custom fit. If you had somebody that was going to either have a bike built or by some manufacturer or whatever, you looked in the Coney book and kind of use their body measurements to pick out something that looked pretty good, and that's what you went with. And there was no system to actually have somebody that was qualified / trained, whatever, to be able to position somebody virtually any way you wanted. If you were doing a fit, you were usually doing it on a bike the person already had, or you were doing it on, you know, let's say a bike off the rack that you would kind of move around, that sort of thing. So the potential as far as how far you could actually move people and the limitations were still there, if you will. There really was no, you know, at that time, there was no training. Fitters. It was all just kind of stuff that had been handed down over the years from one person to another. So the size cycle kind of looks like a trainer, but it's not. It's an infinitely adjustable bike, if you will, a representation of a bike, so that you could actually put somebody in virtually any position you want to truly dial them into a proper position.
Well, it changed the way I did business Irrevocably. I mean, without it, I cannot even imagine doing the work that we did and still do.
To me, it was a huge accomplishment because it did change the industry. I mean, look at virtually every name brand of bicycles, it seems like, now has their own fit system.
And right.
They were all kind of spawned off the original Cirata SciCycle and fit system that, you know, came from that. You know, one thing led to another, and then the training came in, and Cirata started fit seminars where we dealers came in groups and we trained them to be properly fitting. And you know, eventually it got to be pretty sophisticated where, you know, experts in the field were brought in for various types of fitting, including triathlon, as triathlon grew, and trained experts were brought in to talk to people about the biomechanics and what it all meant, and, you know, to the cyclist specifically and stuff like that. So it got pretty sophisticated, and now it's all, I won't say past history, but now it's, you know, morphed into this thing where, like I say, virtually every larger manufacturer and some not so large are using some form of fitting system, which was, you know, derived somewhat, if not completely, from the original Cirata fit system. And, you know, since I am still doing 100% custom bikes, I don't do any stock bikes whatsoever, everything that I do is, you know, based around that, whether it's, you know, me doing a fit for a customer, a direct customer, or through a dealer, because I sell to both.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. I do want to talk about that. Let me remind our listeners a moment. We're speaking with Kelly Bedford from K. Bedford Custom up in upstate New York. So let's talk about your core customer and the work that you do for individuals. How many of them actually come to you?
Well, not a whole lot of them actually come here. There are people who have come here, but my direct customer business has gone down significantly. My business has grown, but the percentage of business that is direct to customers has gone to a much lower percentage. And I'm doing a lot more sales through dealers now. You know, I push that because unless somebody wants to come here and have a fit here, which, you know, adds a lot of logistics to the whole process, and they're certainly welcome to do that if they want to do that. Cirata had a huge dealer base, and almost all of them, you know, had come to the seminar and were certified and everything. And, of course, being the guy who eventually was doing all of the custom designs there, doing all the custom drafting and stuff like that, I got to know virtually all of these dealers pretty well. When I went on my own, you know, I had this long list, if you will, of really highly qualified dealers, most of whom still exist. So anytime I have a customer that calls up looking for a bike, I will always check with them first to find out what area they're in. And if they're in a relationship distance-wise to a good dealer that I know, I'll send them there.
Wow. You know, you are in the minority of frame builders who do that. But I think that it works really, really well. That's how we, of course, did our business for many, many, many years. Having that relationship means that the person can continually deal with somebody face to face after the sale. So that's kind of a good thing.
It is a good thing. And I mean, there's two sides to that. One, a lot of custom bike builders don't do it because it significantly cuts into their profit margin. There's just no two ways about it. So a lot of the, you know, one-man shops or really small guys like myself don't do that because it's, you know, it just makes it that much tougher to make a living. But on the flip side of the coin, because, you know, the single man shop, if you're successful at all, you're always stretched thin. So having a dealer deal with a lot of the upfront stuff, and also in my case, what's equally or if not more important is knowing that the dealers that I have now are dealers that I know and I trust. So if they send me numbers from a fit, I know I'm working with good numbers. So the likelihood of a bad fit/bad build is is highly unlikely. So for me, there's a level of security there that if I design a bike to this fit, you know, the customers, it's going to, you know, be done correctly right from the, from point A. And also taking some of the front end stress off of me because the dealer is dealing directly with the customer more than I am, which I am always welcome conversations directly with customers. But, you know, once you have the dealer involved, they're the primary contact. So it allows me to stay more focused on, you know, what I do, what I'm good at, which is the building.
Right.
Designing and building. So there's two sides to that coin. You know, you can deal directly with customers and not necessarily be completely sure of the fit because, you know, unless the customer has gone to a dealer and had a fit, and in that case, it may be somebody you don't know, or they're wanting you to just come up with a fit based on what they've had before, okay?
Yeah, we all know where that leads.
Yeah, that's not necessarily always the greatest thing in the world.
Right.
Either. So there's a plus and minus to both sides. While I do deal directly with customers, because sometimes I deal with people who just don't want to deal with a shop, which is rare, or they're just not in an area where it's convenient for them. They're, you know, out of the way somewhere.
Right.
And in that case, we'll deal directly with them. So that's kind of my philosophy on it. You know, I don't want to get into a situation which Serrata ran into at some point later, you know, which was having dealers mad at you because you're selling direct to customers.
Right.
You know, especially if it's someone that's one of their customers, the last thing you want is for someone to show up in their shop with a K Bedford frame and it's a dealer of mine and the dealer had nothing to do with it. That doesn't go over very well.
So. No, it doesn't. So you started out obviously building lugged steel frames, but now you're building tie and carbon, and you even have something called your Alcomp aluminum frame. What's the most popular thing? What's going on right now in your part of the world?
Well, in 2009, I kind of figured since I started, you know, my tenure with Serrata ended at the end of 2008. I just considered 2009, January 1st, 2009, my startup date. Since then, you know, of course, I immediately started with, you know, what I started with way back when, which was a classic lux frame, but it didn't take very long, literally like a matter of just a bare few months before somebody would ask me, can you do TIG welded bike? And yes, and first they asked for steel. And what happened with Serrata was as things were starting to kind of go bad there and wind down, you know, more and more people were, like myself, were getting laid off. And one of the guys that, you know, got laid off was, you know, the guy who had been there as probably the top welder, I guess you could say, for the longest period of time, a guy named Andy Keek. And Andy lives 20 minutes away from me, and he's a very, very good friend and a superb welder. So I called Andy, and he was looking for work, so we added the TIG Feel Comp frame, which is just same tubing and everything you'd use in a lug frame, but you had a little more latitude on tubing diameters and everything. And we started doing the TIG steel, and immediately, I mean, literally within weeks, people asked us about, well, can you do tie? And it's like, well, yeah, you know, we had been doing that for years. It didn't take much to tool up to do the different stuff. So we added that. And then a while later, it was kind of my own choice to add the tie carbon frame / I guess you could say it's my version of the Serrata Otro to the line. Because I remember the Otro that I had and what a sensational riding bike it was. So I felt that, and it was, you know, I knew how to do it. So, and there was no reason not to. So we added that to the line, and it all kind of fell together because as I was going more and more to selling bikes through dealers, it was pretty obvious to me that with my profit margin being reduced, that the only way to make up for that was increased volume. So having different models available was the obvious way to increase that volume, because I think with the classic steel frames, there is a finite, if you will, customer base. Doesn't mean I couldn't have made somewhat of a living doing nothing but that, but considering my personal finances and, like I say, making that decision to deal with dealers, it was pretty obvious that I needed to add different models to the line.
I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it gives you some... Yeah, right. I think it's really a kind of a cool thing. How many people work at your facility?
Me?
Just you?
Just me.
Okay.
And I, the way we work it is, I'm not a welder. I mean, I can weld, but I wouldn't send a bike out with my welds on the frame. The frame would stay together, but I'm not at the level of a guy like Andy, okay? Am I, you know, let's say a master level frame builder in the classic frames? Yes. But when it comes to the welding, I have to rely on Andy for that. So basically what I do is, when I get an order for a welded frame, whether it be steel tie or tie carbon, of course I do all the upfront work with the contact, the design, and then, of course, ordering all the materials and do all of the, you know, pre-build processing, which is cutting tubes, mitering tubes, jig setup, all the stuff that goes into getting the frame going. And then once I have all that done, then basically I schedule time with Andy. We get together and he does as well.
What an interesting working model. I really, this is fascinating.
It's different.
It is.
And the welding gets done in stages. We build the bike rear first, and then once the rear is done and I do a little bit more on, you know, beyond that, then Andy and I get back together again. We put a front end on it, and then I take it, once it's welded, I take it from there to the finish, with the exception of paint. And another guy named Bill McDonald, who was the head painter at Serrata for many years, he's a local to the area here, too. He also does, similar to Andy, he does a lot of the paintwork for me. So it's me, but I have, you know, two satellites out there that, you know, have skills that, let's say, I don't necessarily have. And then, you know, they step in and take care of that part, and then I take care of everything else.
So are you delivering mainly finished frame sets, or are you delivering full? You're not delivering bikes, so you're letting the dealer?
Well, if somebody wants to buy a full bike from us, that's fine. I mean, I have an account with Shimano and stuff like that. So can I do full bikes?
Right.
Yes. They'll get calls for that, not very often. But if somebody doesn't want to, if it's a, and usually it's a direct sale. Very, you know, dealers are always going to want to do the components themselves. So if I have a customer who is a direct sale and they don't want to be bothered with searching down all the stuff, they may just tell me, look, I want, you know, a titanium road bike, and I want to do, let's say, Altegra DI2 stuff on it and whatnot, then we will do the whole thing for them and send them a complete bike ready to ride if they want. But it's not very often. I mean, we're talking maybe a couple times a year.
Yeah. What's your most popular model?
Titanium and the Ti Carbon, believe it or not.
Yeah, I believe it.
Steel has fallen way off.
Interesting.
In fact, it's fallen off enough that now what I'm doing is offering, rather than having, because each frame, the welding is done in stages, so it takes a couple of trips to Andy's to do it. On the steel bikes, rather than doing that, because they're my lowest profit margin bike, what I've started doing this year is, if somebody is dead set they want a TIG welded steel bike, that's fine. But what I've decided to do, and it's maybe a little crazy, I don't know, but one of my fortes in the old days was fillet brazing, and I got very skilled at that. It's not difficult for me to do, so I'm offering the steel bikes in a TIG welded version now for the same price, which there's usually an upcharge for the same price as the TIG welded version. The thought process there is that each time I have to run up to Andy's, it's time away from the shop. So So it's productive time that I could be in the shop doing other things while this welding's going on. If I don't have to run up there, then I'm saving time. And as, you know, in that case, then I can afford to just do the billet brazing, which I do very efficiently, and still kind of fall within that same profit margin and not have to do all the running around that I would do on a TIG frame. So I'm trying that out this year and seeing how it's going. So far, I've only had two orders for them. The demand for steel has dropped off quite a bit.
It's interesting. You know, I'm kind of a Thai fan myself, although steel is real. I won't deny that. You know, we still do a lot of steel stuff. So I want to ask you about your aluminum bike. What's up with that bike?
Well, AL, which is the AL Comp, which just is a short for aluminum, that kind of came from, we got called upon, one of the other guys that I worked with at Cerata, who was in sales there, got involved with Galzetti. Do you know who Galzetti was?
I do.
Okay. Well, he got involved with Galzetti, who Craig had a builder. I think they were over in the Boston area, if I'm not mistaken. And this person, you know, was a friend of Craig's. And Craig is, I think, maybe had a lot on his plate. I don't know all the specifics. But James, who, you know, kind of took over handling a lot of the Galzetti stuff, contacted me about actually taking over the building of it as contract work, which was fine. You know, we had not done aluminum at that point, but Andy knew how to weld aluminum just fine. And I was familiar with the tubing and all that kind of stuff that they were using. So I did my research to make sure we knew all the technical stuff that we needed to know. And it really didn't require any extra tooling or anything. So we embarked on that and started making the aluminum bikes for Galzetti, which went on for maybe a little over a year. And then James decided to pursue another endeavor. And so the whole Galzetti thing kind of, it just went away. But since we had the experience now and, you know, people knew we had been doing aluminum bikes, I figured, well, I wouldn't build the aluminum bikes when we were doing Galzetti, you know, because I didn't want to, you know, under the Bedford name, because I didn't want to create a conflict of interest at that time. But once Galzetti left, which was their own choice, I figured, well, door's kind of open, right? And we know how to do them and whatnot. So I might as well go ahead and, you know, just add them to the line. We know how to do them. You know, we added the aluminum bikes to the line. You know, it's been, I would say, rather from a sales standpoint, unsuccessful. It just doesn't, it hasn't really panned out. You know, I've only had a couple of orders. So it just still seems like titanium and that are, titanium and the Thai carbon are the, really the two most sought after bikes when people are thinking of terms of a full custom bike.
I would tend to agree. When you think of custom, you don't really think that aluminum lends itself as well to the word custom. It seems to be sort of a different type of material. Let me ask you a couple more questions. We don't have a whole lot of time left.
Okay.
Obviously, you still ride, yes?
A lot less than I used to.
Yeah, I know.
I have another sport that I'm involved in that I'm, like, incredibly addicted to.
What's that?
Fly fishing.
Really? Really? We have a really good friend who loves fly fishing, and he's a cyclist, too. So it must have some sort of a connection. Where do you go?
Well, you know, in the area that I live in, upstate New York,
it's
just covered with lakes and streams and stuff like that. I spend a tremendous amount of time fishing in the Hudson River, which is an incredible resource. I don't trout fish that much, even though people think of fly fishing as trout fishing, but I don't trout fish that much. I fish for everything else you can possibly think of, including very large pike and all kinds of stuff. So I'm involved to the point where I do a lot of teaching as far as fly tying, fly casting, and stuff like that. So I'm involved with the American Museum of Fly Fishing in Manchester, Vermont, where the Orvis headquarters are, and stuff like that. So I'm highly involved in it. And when I do have any spare time at all,
that's interesting.
That's what I do. But on the other, you could say it's hydrotherapy because I spend a lot of time walking around like thigh deep and fast running water, so
aqua therapy.
You know, do that for 3 hours. Right. And see how your legs feel. bike to be helpful.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's like climbing Vantu, right? So I have a question about asking you to take a long view back. And tell me what stands out as the thing that's changed the most for bicycle frame builders such as yourself in the last, say, 20 years.
I'd say what's changed the most is the materials, without a doubt. You know, there's, you know, of course, when I started and all the way up into the 90s, when at Serrata, for example, when we started with titanium, which was our first foray into TIG welded bikes, you know, everything was classic. It was all lug steel. The best bike you could buy was all handmade lug steel bikes. So the introduction of the new materials into the picture has been the biggest thing. Of course, you had steel, and then, you know, there were some really early forays into, like with Teledyne, into titanium, but they really didn't know what they were doing back then, so they didn't fly because they all kind of came apart. But then aluminum came on the scene, and then a few years later, titanium had a resurrection once they figured out which material was the way to do it and the rough techniques and all that kind of stuff. And we all know what's happened with carbon. So,
right.
It's been the progress in the materials, mostly. You know, as far as the custom frame builder goes, it was interesting to me that very, very, very early on, little story here. The guy that I worked in the shop with he and I built our first frames together. When I got my tuning, I told him, "Hey, Mark, you should get some so we could do this together." And he goes, "Oh, no, we can't do that." I go, what do you mean we can't do that? And he goes, "Oh, no, that's very, very, you know, that's very special. You got to do an apprenticeship. You got to learn that from the masters." And I'm like, "No, not really. It's like geometry and it's metalworking skills and stuff like that. So we can do it." And my father was an aircraft mechanic all his life. So we were taught to do everything with our hands, and you didn't throw stuff away and buy new stuff. You fixed everything. So I was kind of used to doing stuff like that anyway. So he got tubing too, and we did it. And it was pretty, I guess you could say, pretty homegrown. You know what I mean? You could build bikes without jigs. You could, and it was all basic tools and basic skills and materials that you were using. So virtually anybody could do it. And, you know, this generation of American builders sprung up, and this might anger some people, but the Americans, the European bikes were put together pretty quickly, and they looked really good and stuff like that. But the American builders took it to a whole nother level, and they started going crazy with immense amount of finish work, and they put a lot more into the aesthetics than had been being done before. So they kind of took it to another level, and that's what I did too, and still do, on the classic lug frames and whatnot. And that tradition is actually kind of carried through into the other materials too. So I think American frame builders getting involved in the whole show helped to elevate that, some of that stuff also. But it's just been an evolution in materials, which is just like any other industry. You know, the aerospace industry is the same way. You know, airplanes started out as wood and cloth, and they went to aluminum, and now they're, you know, you get on an airplane to go fly to another, you know, another state or whatever, and it's 65% composites.
Right. Right.
You know.
You begin to wonder, is it going to stay in the air? But that's another story. So, well, Kelly, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I learned a lot, as I always do. I have my three final questions for you. What's your favorite food?
Oh, boy. In general, I would say not one specific thing, but seafood.
Oh,
I don't get very often, but I love seafood. I was brought up on that since I was raised in South Florida.
Grouper's one of my favorite.
Yeah, I could literally eat like probably 2 pounds of just boiled shrimp with nothing else on it at a sitting.
What kind of music do you listen to?
I have probably well over 100 vinyl albums sitting in a closet if I ever get another turntable and whatnot from the 70s. So a lot of the 70s stuff, but I have a very open palate when it comes to music. I mean, I can hear something when I'm watching videos, for example, on fly fishing, fly tying, psych, whatever. And, you know, when people do their own videos, they put music to it, and I'll hear something that sounds good. I'll figure out who it was. And, you know, I pick up a lot of stuff from that, from unknown artists. But one of the people I'm listening to now is I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him here, because he's, you know, only really well known in Europe for the most part, as an Israeli guy named Asaf Avedon.
Huh. Well, now I'm going to have to go look.
Yeah, he's got a lot of, he's a singer-songwriter, plays different instruments. He's all self-taught, but he has a very unusual voice, and he doesn't have you listen to him speak, he doesn't have an accent at all. He talks English very, you know, he just sounds like he's from America, but very interesting sound, but I like a lot of off-the-wall stuff, not crazy.
Come on, you're in the bicycle business. Of course you like off-the-wall stuff, right?
No, you know, I know a lot of guys that, you know, I don't know, some of the stuff, I can't remember his name. A lot of the guys that I knew listened to him. He was married to, I think, Ricky Lee Jones for a while. I can't remember his name.
Oh, I don't know. You got me on that one.
Some of the stuff I know that some brain builders listen to, I find pretty depressing most of the time. So
I hope not. I don't like
a little more upbeat, and like I say, I like finding new stuff, people, and God, I started listening to some stuff by a group called Omnia, which is pagan folk music.
Okay,
weird, but
it does.
It's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting stuff. It's not like when you say pagan, it's not all this weird, you know, like dark. It's good stuff.
Okay, and my last question is
Celtic stuff. Yeah.
Do you have any pets?
Yeah, I got a herd.
All right. What's in your herd?
I'm a cat guy.
Wait a minute. And herding cats is a whole different.
Well, when I say a herd, I have far too many of them. My wife, probably 8 years ago or so, she started working at the Saratoga County Animal Shelter, which was
always a mistake. Always a mistake.
So we always had like one or two cats, but which we had when we moved into the house we're in now, and she started doing fostering. So, you know, it seemed like at any given time we could have one or more like brand new kittens in our house that she was fostering, and that's deadly because then you inevitably fall in love with one and you don't want to give it back. So we ended up until about 8 or 9 months ago, we ended up, believe it or not, with 7 cats. And one of them, who was not a foster from the animal shelter, but he just, in the house we lived in before, he just showed up and found us when he was very young. He just passed away a few months ago. So we're down to, we're slowly whittling down. We're down to 6 now. So that's why I say we have a herd,
right.
Until at like 6:30 in the evening, if you go into the kitchen, you see what you would see. What I mean when there's like this herd of them milling around your feet, all whining for food. So,
Kelly, thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with me today.
Well,
it's a pleasure to learn more about Kay Bedford Design. We will post a link to your website and remind people that there is a dealer network, which I think is really special. I like that. And maybe we'll meet up sometime when we're in upstate New York.
Oh, that sounds fine. If you're ever in the area, just, you know, I'm usually always here, but I have to run errands sometimes, stuff like that. So if you're ever around, just give me a ring. If I'm here, you're welcome to come anytime.
Thanks a lot. You have a great day.
Sure.
All righty.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Kelly Bedford joined me from his shop in upstate New York. What an interesting conversation. Learned a lot, as always, fly fishing. Well, now there's a sport I never thought I'd get into. I'm glad to hear that it's alive and well and that he's so involved in it. I'd like to thank him for being on the show this week. I'd also like to thank Niles Barnes for helping to expand on the East Coast Greenway River Rally coming up next week. You can find out more information about that at greenway.org. That is our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.